So welcome to the Atom Ventures podcast. I'm here with Adrian James from Shopper.
Hello. Hi. Pleased to be on your podcast. Thank you.
And we're recording this over the web, so it's one of the few non-in-person podcasts that we're having. So hopefully everything will go smoothly. So Adrian, can you give us a little bit of background about yourself and what exactly Shopper is?
Okay, so background, best part of a decade in working at Oracle and Adobe, mainly in analytics, and then came out of that and decided to do something entirely stupid and work in the world of startups. This is what my third. And it came about after I exited the last business called WattBase, which is an IoT analytics business. And my wife and I were trying to, you know, work out what we were doing with our shopping at the time of Christmas of 2017. And my wife, who works for a well-known bank, said that the biggest problem we have is there's lack of data in banking applications. So from my background in working with data, I then thought, well, what if we married email receipts with open banking data, and we'd be able to tell what we bought online, on what card, and what we were refunded, and that would help us with our Christmas shopping. That was Genesis.
So what does Shopper do exactly?
So Shopper is an application that takes the email receipts on your smartphone, just your receipts, not your emails to granny or anything else like that. And it pulls it out, and then it pulls the data from open banking, and it says this receipt marries to this credit or debit card transaction, which we've taken from open banking. And what we do is we do that all on your smartphone. So we utilize a chip on your smartphone. Most people on this podcast will have an iPhone or an Android device, and they have a discrete chip on it, which is an artificial intelligent chip, and it's used for processing at the moment. Most of the time it's used for processing dogs and pictures, but what we've used it for is for pulling the data out of the email receipt and then matching that to the open banking data. But the beautiful thing is none of the data goes to the cloud, so it's totally private and secure.
So basically what you're saying there is everything is there is no transfer to your servers or anything like that. The data is...
we don't have any servers.
Right. Okay. So that's interesting, because obviously once, I guess the key thing really people will be worried about is access to the email, right?
Yeah. And because what we've done is just said, right. And it came about because of GDPR, 2018 GDPR came in and we'd built a whole infrastructure, which was all an architecture, sorry, which was all about processing things in the cloud. And we went, this ain't going to work. And so we decided to sort of move that all onto the machine learning chip on the phone, so that we could go around the problem of GDPR and get over people's concerns about privacy and security of data.
So you're also the CEO of Monoly. Can you explain a little bit about Monoly and Shopper and how they all work together, or do they work?
Right. So when we were designing this wonderful shopping application, which shows you your purchases and items, prices, and what your refunds were, we suddenly thought to ourselves, well, actually, probability is banks would need it, because in the world of payments, payment gateways are built for security, reliability, and speed. What they're not built for is transferring what was bought in a purchase from the e-commerce system to the issuing bank. They just transfer the aggregate amount. So we knew that there was a problem with nobody really populating what you purchased into a banking app. So we launched an API, but we did it under the brand Monoly, so that people could download and utilize the application. It's sold on AWS and through our own site, api.monoly.co. So people can take it and play around and then start to do what you called in the world of payments, data enrichment, transactional data enrichment.
So, today I've just noticed actually in both of my banking apps that they've made some improvements on insights and analytics. However, it's still quite generic. So I can get information that I've spent X amount on PayPal, but I don't really know. There's many different things I would purchase via PayPal. So how is Shopper and Monoly different? What kind of level of granularity do you get from those apps?
Well, Shopper and the Monoly as an API will provide Shopper as an application will tell you exactly what you purchased. It'll show you an image of what you purchased. It'll give you a description of what you purchased, the quantities. It'll give you the unit price. So if you've got an order that, say, you've gone to Zara and you bought three items, a pair of jumper, trousers, and a shirt, for example, it'll give you each individual item and the item prices, the quantities of those, and a description of the item, plus obviously the item's picture. So if you were in a bank, a banking app, you would be able to see not just the total order value, but every individual item that you bought. Other applications of it is in your banking app, you'd be able to see that every individual thing that you bought from Sainsbury's. So if you do online shopping, you'd be able to see you bought fish fingers, potatoes, strawberries, orange juice, and the item prices beside it, which will give a much more richer user experience for the banking app user. Whereas what they do today, as you quite rightly point out, is you get the aggregate amount, but nothing else.
So this is really quite powerful. So essentially what you're saying is that if I go to Tesco's buy fish fingers, I can find out if I went to Sainsbury's 5 days later whether I paid more or less for those fish fingers, right?
Yeah, you could do comparatives. In the Shopper app, we're going to bring out a feature in the new year which allows you to see where you got something's cheaper. So you've got, and we have a little database on the app which says how many days you've got to return something. So if it's, for example, from ASOS, 180 days to give you to return something. If we see that same item for sale somewhere else cheaper, we'll show you it cheaper and you'll be able to return it because you know it's free returns on ASOS and buy it cheaper somewhere else. So we can use this, you can use the information in a multitude of ways to help the consumer get a cheaper price, but also help them understand what they bought. And generally just give us a catalogue of everything we ever buy, which is something which we all struggle with.
It's also can be quite scary to actually see the detail of what you're actually spending your money on, right? But then I guess that's the way to help you understand where maybe you're spending too much money.
Yeah, so we can we got in a product roadmap for Shopper is things like how much you spend on shoes, how much do you, we can do we're going to introduce as well things like subscription management, so we can tell you where you've what you've got you're paying X amount on Netflix every month, or you've also got Prime and it's gone past the date that you had for a special offer. Do you still want to keep it? But all that stuff goes in your email receipts. So all we do is we scavenge it from it. Married it to the bank account details to make sure it's not fraudulent, and let you have the ability to manage your cash correctly.
So it's essentially one of the big things here is you're exposing the hidden data that sits in your email account, essentially.
Exactly, and we're a bunch of data scientists, and data science traditionally has to create its data in order to actually mine it. In this, we were sitting on what? How long has email been around for? About 30 odd years. The 30 years repository of data of which to mine. So from a data science point of view, that's like a magic treasure trove.
So one question around that, so machine learning, AI. Now, obviously you said data is important, obviously that's linked to accuracy. So do you know how accurate you are really with all the
We're about 98% correct on the data which we extract from email and a match to an open banking transaction. And that's because we have analyzed probably in excess of over 1 million emails, which we have either bought products on or taken from family members, friends, beta users. And we use that to incorporate into our training models, which then mean that our machine learning is continually being updated. So that we get a performant application.
So if I'm, is Shopper live now? You mentioned beta users. Is it live at the moment?
Yeah, it's on App Store.
So what's the
App
process
Store.
if I log in? So just to kind of give people a flavor of what they would need to do once they've downloaded Shopper.
Sure. So when you download Shopper, you've got a series of onboarding screens which explain a little bit about it. But you'll get to the point where it asks you to select your email provider. So we've incorporated Microsoft at the minute and Google because they're the two major email providers who provide a free email service and everyone uses it. If you take, for example, we just go into the Gmail, what we'll then do is it'll go into Gmail and you'll see the same screens that you do for any application on the internet at the minute. It says, do you grant access to calendars? Do you grant access to email? Do you grant access to your Google Drive? Right? Exact same. It uses a protocol, and for those who are more technically gifted, using an OAuth protocol, which is the same security protocol as we use for open banking. It then says, put in your email address, or if it's in your keychain on your phone, you just defaults into it. And likewise with your passport. That is all held by Google. That has nothing to do with us as a company. That is your relationship with Google. You give authorization. And in our case, you just give read authorization. We don't ask you for write or access to your calendars or any other nonsense like that. Just read. We then, they'll be presented the second screen, which is, do you want to then integrate your bank? And again, we're using open banking here. You will then be redirected to your bank. The bank then says, hey, do you want to give access to this company for it? Yes, no. But if you don't want to do that, you don't have to do that. We've designed the application compartmentalized so that if you just want to just get a list of everything you purchased from your email receipts, fine. If you want to then marry that to your bank account, you can do that too. But they're not that you can still download the email and then not put the bank account if you feel worried about that. What then happens is then you open the app, and what's really interesting is when you see users on like an iPhone 5 or an iPhone 4 and you watch it, you realize how slow their processes are. When you stick this on an iPhone X or XR or anything which is a little bit more speedy, it's like lightning because it's using the processor on the telephone to pull the data, the emails out of the email inbox, and then match it to the bank to the bank or credit card details. And it does that, and you start to see emails which maybe got three or four different things on the item or in the order, sorry, being broken up into individual line items. So, you know, pair of shoes, $29.99, size 10, shirt, size XL, £22.99, color brown, color pink, color whatever. And you start seeing that coming up. And then also we populated this with a database that says how long you got to return. It automatically shows you which items are still returnable and which are not. And if you choose to return something, then when the refund comes back in, we match it against what you've indicated you've returned and show the money's gone back on the credit or debit card.
Okay, so this all sounds great, sounds wonderful. So, I guess one of the key things that's popping up in my head is that you say that you don't, you're obviously not taking any information from the devices themselves. I guess you're aggregating it on the phone, and displaying it back. So you've got no servers holding any one of the any user's personal information. You're presenting all this information back to the user. My question is, how do you guys make money? What's the? It sounds
So
fantastic, but. It sounds a bit
there's
too
multiple
tricky.
ways we make money. So we're introducing a couple of features. First one is three main ones. So let's say you have a product which you purchased before, but you can't remember where you bought it from. We're putting a buy again link on there, right? So we'll generate affiliate revenue. If, for example, you buy a toaster, we'll scan the internet for you and find out where you could have got it cheaper. If you choose to accept that product, we make affiliate revenue from that. And we're introducing finally, just before Christmas, on our roadmap is something which we've done a lot of user testing around and a lot of research around, and that is a sell again feature. Sorry, an eBay function. We did this piece of research asking people why people couldn't be bothered getting rid of all the date, all the dross they've got in their house. You know, the stuff they bought, which they couldn't be bothered getting rid of, couldn't bother returning in some cases. And they said, why aren't you posting all this stuff on eBay? Oh, I can't be bothered. I can't be bothered taking a photograph, writing a description, putting the price in, da, da, da. And so what we realized is that we had the image, we had the description. We could take that and pre-populate that into eBay using their API. And we've got it down to about three clicks to post something which you own into eBay without having to take photographs, populate descriptions. You just set the price and go.
That's very impressive, actually. That's and I definitely have suffered from that, where I have about 18 hip flasks for some reason that people keep sending me, and I keep randomly. And I know I need to get rid of them, but I just can't be bothered to take the photo. So yes, I see that that's a huge benefit for people. So where do you see that? I mean, where do you see things going with Shopper? What's the plan going forward? Obviously, you've given us a little taste of the roadmap now. Where do you see this progressing in the next year?
So the overall strategy, Shopper for me is a massive Trojan horse, right? We're going to build a business, generate revenue from it, work out how people, but in tandem, we're going to be selling the technology to banks and financial institutions, the underlying technology of Shopper. And that's where we see the long-term business. So Shopper is about educating financial institutions on using email with banking data. to get around what is an industry problem, which is a paucity of data on transactions. So the long-term vision on this business is to sell the underlying technology. We already have Money Dashboard starting to incorporate the technology into their personal financial management application, which hopefully will go in next year. But what we don't see that. We want that to go. We want us to go into every application. And there's a really big reason why financial institutions, certainly retail banks, have got will have a necessity for this. And that is the user experience. They're all starting to lose monthly active users. They're getting the downloads, but the only thing people are using this for is to check that they've been paid or that money's been taken out of their account. And as they shut branches, they're losing that as a channel of which to upsell in. So they need more stickability in their applications. So better data, more stickability. The other reason is because of fraud. If you have a transaction on your account, which currently you see and you go, hey, what was that for? Invariably, you go back to your email account to go and see what that transaction was for and go, ah, yeah, no, I now remember where I spent it, right? But if you don't have a receipt, we can flag it as fraud, right? And then it saves people picking up the phone to the bank and saying, hey, I think I've got fraud on my account. Because at the moment, there's around about 30 million calls going to UK banks asking, what was that on my account? And now that, for as an industry benchmark, is £5 a call. So if you could imagine halving that or quartering that, or, you know, and that's even just for the phone call. What about the fraud inquiry itself? The fraud inquiry itself is hugely costly to the bank. But just by having better data, they don't have the necessity to pick up the phone, incur that cost. So we're looking at actually helping banks lower their costs, reduce fraud, and give a better experience.
So how have you found the discussion with the banks, especially around open banking? Because there's obviously, we were at the FinTech Festival in Scotland last week, and there was great focus on open banking. How do you see that market? How do you see banks embracing it?
So I've been in to see a lot of the banks, and you know, sitting down with them, they all know the problem. They really know the problem. But as one of the execs of a well-known high street branch bank said to me, you know, Adrian, I know I've got this problem. I know this is a massive issue for us. I know how much it costs us, but I will not be the person on the front page of the Daily Mail saying, this bank is reading my email. I just won't do it. It's too much, right? So until it's socialized as a reasonable thing to do, to let a bank access your email, even if it's on your phone, to let that just from a public relations point of view, to do that. And we have, and customers are educated that if they just create a new email account, free, doesn't cost anything, put all your receipts in there, and then we pull the email out of that. Until that education level's up there, we can't take this solution.
So right? are you seeing differences in different types of banks? So the challenger banks versus the more institutional ones?
The challenger banks is strange. I've definitely had interest, one in particular. I can't talk about who they are, but definitely. But the challenger banks at the moment are spending most of their cash on marketing, right? It's acquisition. And they're putting some features in there, but ostensibly they're just still really replicating what is a high street bank. So they're not going crazy and doing wild things. They're just offering more, I just call it lipstick on a pig, right? They're not fundamentally changing the model. So there's some that are interested. What's going to take is for real disruption in the industry to start, and real innovators in the industry to start thinking laterally about how to solve some of the problems of their industry. And open banking at the moment, while it's a wonderful opportunity, is still in its genesis.
Yes, very right. I think in the retail space, it's definitely much more mature than in the SME market. And I think that's where, that's a lot of very interesting things can happen there as well. And I actually can see that for a shopper, that there is a B2B play or a business play as well, right?
No, you're bang on. We have looked at using the technology to do automated expense processing. So if you take, for example, one of bugbear of mine, I used to, you know, working in Oracle, you're doing all your expenses and you have to fill out the spreadsheet. We're starting to automate that with applications like Free Agent, like Expenditure, Xero. All these applications are in the business of trying to make that easy. But they've all gone down the route of photographing expenses, which, if you're a business person, most of your expenses, certainly your plane tickets, your hotels, everything goes into your email. So they've not looked at doing that. We can automate it so it can pull out your stuff out of your email, put it into the Xero or whatever application you use for expenses, and auto create an expense report. That expense report, we can then, because we have the receipt data from the email, we can pull out the VAT, send that to HMRC, and automatically pay back the individual on the expense incurred, all seamlessly.
Yeah, and that's huge. And yeah, so you're right. I think a lot of the same problem that goes for individuals happens to companies. They get their invoices in their mailbox, and it may even be that invoices are missed because of the fact that they're in people's email inboxes, right? So this is a way of ensuring that they get into the right system straight away. So yeah.
And it's just routing rules. It really is. It's as simple as that. Once you've stripped the email, parsed the email of its requisite data, it's just about routing it into the correct, against the right person to create the right expense report, and then sending it to HMRC. It's just routing rules.
So just to carry on with a bit of shopping, you're looking for investment at the moment, right?
Yes, yes,
So how is that all going?
yes. So we started the round. So we're raising 350,000. And we're about 30%, so we are pushing on, trying. We have a close relationship with Money Dashboard, who obviously have taken our technology as well. So at the moment, we're speaking to a lot of their investors, as well as I brought on a new non-executive, Ben Corrigan. Ben's an ex-Dragon's Den winner. Told the likes of Deborah Meaden and whatnot to do one because he didn't want their money, and went and raised a huge amount more money from external investors, but used the publicity from Dragon's Den. So fair play to him. But he then exited his existing business, or the business he also owned, to Daily Mail, and has come on board with Shopper as a non-exec. So he's investing as well as going out and encouraging investors to get involved in our project.
I noticed that you can currently have an iPhone app only for Shopper. When does the Android version get to the market?
After Christmas, that's part of our raise, is about taking the development we've done and porting it across. I think we're built on React, so it's more a case of just doing the porting of the code, and then testing it to the point where we're happy with it and releasing it into Google Play.
Right, cool. So now we have an understanding of Shopper. I'd just like to talk a little bit about your own personal journey and becoming an entrepreneur. This is your third startup. So
Yeah,
has it
I had
become
a
easier each
JavaScript
time?
business. Sorry?
Has it become easier each time?
No. And this is my first one where I've got a big B2C play on it. I've never done B2B business, B2C businesses, right? This is it's new for me in that respect. It's hugely enjoyable because mentally, you're doing something which is really outside your comfort zone. But prior to that, Whatbase was an IT venture, very different to what we're talking about now. It's about using web, kind of web analytics in the physical retail. And for that, I've done a JavaScript business, which is about doing container tags. And the main difference with this one is that the B2C angle and the level of sophistication involved in it. We've been a year developing this technology now, and it's not been easy because it's not been Apple's core machine learning product. Core ML isn't particularly mature, so we've had to build a lot of this. But I'd say comparatively, we're in fintech as opposed to martech, which is what the JavaScript business was, or IoT. This is much more enjoyable because you're seeing a massive change in fintech. The financial industry is genuinely ripe for change, whereas martech is quite mature now, and the IoT business is probably a 20-year journey for those involved in it.
Definitely. So, how do you, as I mentioned before, we were part of the FinTech Festival. So, how do you feel about the FinTech world up in Scotland? How's the community? How's that work for you?
Oh, well, the community is very strong. Obviously, as yourself, but it genuinely is quite strong because, certainly in the region Edinburgh where I am, there's a lot of banks, a lot of insurers, and so there's a nice sort of mix of mature business as well as startups, which does create a lot of understanding in the market of the potential of financial technologies. So you're not sort of fighting this, you're not fighting a ignorance here. You're fighting, you're, you, you know, it allows you to focus on other challenges. It also means a resource can come from financial backgrounds, which means you're not having to educate them in financial technologies or compliance or understanding regulatory frameworks. You kind of got that already. So a lot of real advantages. And I built a business, building businesses in other countries, down London way. Done. It's just there's maybe a lot more money down there and a lot more in terms of startups. But it's perhaps not that sort of more intimate feel you get up here.
Yeah, I mean the collaboration in Scotland is I'm not gonna say necessarily unique, but it is very, very strong. It's almost like working in a small state in the US, right, where everyone knows each other and you can get to the right people quickly, and everyone's happy to make introductions, where I guess in London people are a little bit less willing to share their smarties in some respects.
Yeah. And we talked about FinTech Scotland, Stephen Englehart and Michael Paris. You've got an organization there, staff of people from the financial services industry who get financial and want it to be successful. And then you've obviously got the universities, you've got the private sector finance, the angel communities. So it does create a nice sort of group who, as you say, are all trying to work towards a common objective.
So, have you worked much with the universities up there? Because obviously, Edinburgh University does have a very strong informatics department, given their high ML.
No, but one of our data scientists was at I think one of their spin-outs, Data Lab. So he gained a huge amount of experience, which obviously we benefited from in the world of data science.
So, there'll be people listening to this podcast that have. Or still be working at places like Oracle, Adobe, large businesses. What would you say to them if they're sitting there twiddling their thumbs thinking, well, maybe I want to take that leap and start my own business? What would you say to them?
I would genuinely think very, very carefully about it, because my transition from a corporate person into a startup person was fraught with thing falling over, right? It literally falling over because you don't realize just how much of a big blanket which is around you. Nice, soft, snuggly blankets which allows you to pass things off which ordinarily you wouldn't be able to in a startup. So, if you haven't done your VAT return in a startup, then you're the one who loses. Well, if you haven't done VAT in Oracle, well, it doesn't matter really because it's not your department. The sleepless nights of raising finance, of trying to make sure you can make payroll at the end of the month. If you haven't got a bit of steel about you, don't bother doing it because it will come to you. And it's unusual that you get incredibly well-financed businesses from the get-go, which allow you to not think about things like that and focus on the area that you want to focus on, which is perhaps, the architecture of the product roadmap, or other things. You have to genuinely be a jack of all trades. So, I think saying to people in Oracle and Adobe who want to, I've known who wanted to start, I said, just be very prepared to get a very bruised backside, and watch your savings being depleted rapidly.
True. I think what I find quite funny is that, you start a business based on that you want to do this thing. There's a great, let's say you're good at a certain activity and you want to do that and promote that out to the wider world, but you actually spend 80% of your time not doing that piece of work, but doing all the bits around it, business development, as you say, finance, accounting, marketing, all of that. And you don't always necessarily concentrate on that thing that you thought that you would be doing 100% of the time once you start that business.
And it's like when you and I would go for a beer. You got to be prepared to do that, and I enjoy that, which is kind of helpful. I enjoy beer, but you've got to be prepared to sort of go that part where perhaps the kids need to be taken to something, and you need to try and arrange other things to do that, or you've got some social engagement which falls on a night where you could be networking. You just got to do the networking. You don't have a choice in that. Because the more visibility you get, the more people remember your company, its name, and what it does, the more chances you have of being successful. So it's a numbers game in that respect. And when I worked in Oracle, if I don't want to go out in the evening, I didn't go out in the evening. I could go cycling or do whatever I want. I can't relax in the same way I did.
That's very true. I tell most people that my day starts at 7 p.m. or 6 p.m. Right? That when you're actually having to go out and do that networking and sell what it is that you do.
Yeah, and then you can't be tired of the message either, right? You can't be tired of saying the same thing continually and continually, because it's who you are. You also become badged as, hi, this is Adrian James from Shopper. Well, actually, no, I'm just Adrian. No, you're from Shopper, and two become synonymous. So you have to be prepared for people to see you as your company, and all that ensues.
So, final question for you. If you had a time machine and you could go back 20 years in time and meet your younger self, what advice would you give yourself?
Do this earlier. Do this earlier. Just, I wish I could go back to the 90s and into the early noughties when I didn't have kids, mortgage, etc., etc. And I was free and able to do it. I wish I could go back earlier and get on doing this quicker, because building a business is great fun, but the more that you have the normal things of life and having children and whatnot, the harder this is, because you're not compromised in, giving time to your children, giving time to your wife or to your family or to anything else. Just get on it, just get it done, and also you'll catch the bug of it. That's the thing, is it is actually a bit of a bug. I know you've got the bug. I certainly have got the bug of it. It probably makes us unemployable again.
Definitely.
But is that a bad thing? You know what? It's not a bad thing. It's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think on that specific point, I think that because you're out meeting a whole bunch of people you wouldn't normally meet if you were working in a large business, you're exposed to so many different things that you didn't necessarily know existed out there, and some very, very intelligent, very clever people. So there are actually more opportunities to find a job in this world. Because there are just so many people that you'll meet, and there are so many new things that are going on, that there'll be more that excites you than let's say if you're going from one large company to another large company, because it's essentially they're the same thing. Whereas here, the variety is amazing. So.
I also think that because I went down the corporate route initially, I possibly became a little arrogant, if I'm going to be brutally honest with myself, in that I thought I knew it all. I thought I knew business. It's only when you are going through, as I did in one business before, getting to Christmas time and I couldn't afford to make payroll and not being able to pay myself for months, just to keep the business going, did you realize that, this is tough stuff? But never felt more alive when I was doing that, than I was in Oracle. At Oracle, I wasn't alive in that respect. I wasn't living perhaps as much on the edge, which some people might not like. But, to your previous question, what would you say to people? Really consider what that feels like, because it ain't comfortable, but you'll feel alive. And to my younger self, at least I'd have had less to lose as a younger person.
So that's interesting, and that's something one thing that I'd like to explore a little bit more, because when I talk to people, I always say that you're in your 20s you develop your skills, and your 30s develop your network, and then in your 40s you use your network and your skills. But what you're saying is actually that for you what's become more important is the work-life balance, and you think that you don't necessarily need that same extensive level of skills or network in order to do what you're doing, and you could have done that, you had a bit more freedom basically when you were younger than necessarily now.
Yeah, I could have done, and I think, I've always been a driven person, and that was a something which, if I was to do this 20 years ago, I'd have still had that same drive, and I would have still gone out and acquired the same skills, and I'd have still fallen over in the same way. Whereas doing it the corporate route that I did, I had my backside washed, and I did it in a very strong, soft way. I had a soft sort of, because you're focusing on your career, you learn to become a politician
Sure.
very quickly in a corporate environment, and you go on courses, which is all great, but you're not really doing it out of necessity. You're doing it because you want to develop your career a bit more, or develop a bit more skills. Whereas the stuff I learn now is because I have to learn it.
Yes, no one wants to learn about VAT returns, that's for sure. But yeah, no, I agree with you 100%. Well, Adrian, thanks for that. It's been a very interesting conversation.
Good. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Excellent.
Next time we do it in person, no? Huh?
Definitely, definitely. With some beers.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I appreciate everyone listening as well.
Thanks.